In a world where technology has advanced, but humanity's spiritual nature remains unchanged, Robert Hugh Benson's Lord of the World stands as a chilling prophecy. Written in 1907, this dystopian novel has been cited by both Pope Francis and Pope Benedict XVI as a must-read warning about the dangers of spiritual emptiness and false messianism. The book depicts a future where secularism has triumphed, supernatural religion is marginalized, and humanity turns to worship itself, until a charismatic figure emerges who seems to fulfill all human hopes while demanding complete allegiance. What makes this century-old novel particularly unsettling is how many of its predictions about technology, politics, and the spiritual crisis of modernity have come to pass, making it not just a fascinating literary work, but a profound examination of human nature when faced with the divine or its counterfeit. The world Benson creates is hauntingly familiar yet alien, a society that has achieved material progress while suffering spiritual bankruptcy. Set in the early 21st century, humanity has embraced communism and humanitarianism as its guiding principles, transforming them into quasi-religious movements that fill the void left by traditional faith. The novel presents a world where scientific advancement and social engineering have created a superficial utopia that masks a profound spiritual emptiness at its core. Traditional religions have largely collapsed, with Catholicism standing as the last significant bulwark against the secular order. The church maintains its structure, but operates from the margins of society, viewed with suspicion and contempt by the governing authorities. Technology has transformed daily life in ways that seem both wondrous and dehumanizing. Volars, flying machines, cross continents at tremendous speeds. Artificial sunlight bathes London streets in perpetual illumination, and instantaneous communication systems connect the globe in a web of constant information exchange. These technological marvels serve as both convenience and distraction, keeping humanity's gaze firmly fixed on material concerns. The novel opens with Mr. Templeton's detailed explanation to Father Percy Franklin about society's gradual slide into communism. This transformation occurred not through revolution, but through subtle legislative changes, reorganized pension systems that redistributed wealth, prison reforms that emphasized rehabilitation over punishment, education acts establishing dogmatic secularism as the only acceptable worldview, and inheritance tax reforms implementing Marxist doctrines of wealth redistribution. These changes, implemented over decades, effectively dismantled traditional social structures and religious institutions. The world has consolidated into three competing power blocks: the Eastern Empire, dominated by a resurgent Asian alliance, the European African territories, united under a socialist bureaucracy, and the American Republic, which maintains an uneasy independence. Within this tripartite division, Catholics have become a marginalized minority, comprising only a tiny fraction of the global population and facing increasing hostility from secular authorities. This world embodies what James Shaw in the foreword describes as the flatness and boredom of a world without God. The architecture reflects this spiritual vacuum. Buildings are designed for pure utility, stripped of ornament and religious symbolism. Political structures emphasize efficiency and control, while social institutions promote collective identity over individual spiritual development. The novel's physical landscape mirrors its spiritual barrenness. Cities are perfectly ordered, yet soulless, efficient, yet devoid of beauty. Oliver Brand, a communist member of parliament, exemplifies the new humanity, finding comfort in this vast hive of men and women who had learned at least the primary lesson of the gospel, that there was no God but man, no priest but the politician, no prophet but the schoolmaster. The novel brilliantly portrays how a society that rejects God doesn't become more rational, but instead redirects its religious impulses towards secular objects of worship: the state, technology and humanity itself become new idols, demanding devotion while offering no transcendent meaning in return. Against this backdrop emerges the novel's most fascinating character, Julian Felsenburgh. He first appears as Rumors, a mysterious American politician with extraordinary linguistic abilities and charismatic power. His initial achievement is resolving the conflict between East and West seemingly overnight through sheer force of personality. When he finally appears in London, the crowd's reaction is religious in nature. They fall silent in awe before him. Felsenburgh is physically striking, 33 years old, Christ's age at crucifixion, with white hair and dark eyes. His oratorical power is unprecedented. He speaks 15 languages and seems to understand all cultures. Most importantly, he embodies what the secular world desires: peace, brotherhood, and unity without the demands of traditional religion. As Mr. Markham describes him, he is the first perfect product of cosmopolitan creation. What makes Felsenburgh such a compelling antagonist is that he isn't obviously evil. He promotes peace, unity, and human dignity. Yet there's something fundamentally wrong in his vision. He positions himself as the fulfillment of humanity's religious longings, declaring universal brotherhood and praising the world spirit. His followers begin to worship him, kneeling before his picture and calling his name in moments of crisis. Benson's portrayal of Felsenburgh is a masterful study in the psychology of false messianism. He doesn't need to threaten or coerce. People willingly surrender their freedom to him. When he's appointed president of Europe with unprecedented powers, final veto authority, and the ability to enact any measure introduced 3 consecutive years, people celebrate this concentration of power. Even Oliver Brand, initially a rational politician, declares, "Why, I would die for him." The novel suggests that when transcendent faith disappears, people don't become more rational. They become vulnerable to charismatic leaders who promise to fulfill their spiritual longings through political means. Felsenburgh represents not the absence of religion, but its perversion, the worship of humanity in place of God. As secular humanism triumphs under Felsenburgh's leadership, the Catholic Church stands as the last significant opposition. Benson portrays this resistance not as political activism, but as spiritual witness. The Church retreats to Rome, which becomes a sanctuary for believers, divided into cultural quarters: Anglo-Saxon, Latin, Teutonic, and Eastern, each maintaining their distinctive architecture and traditions. Father Percy Franklin emerges as the novel's protagonist and moral center. With his white hair and young face, he bears an uncanny resemblance to Felsenburgh, a kind of antithesis, a reverse of the medal. As Cardinal Protector of England and eventually Pope Sylvester III, Percy embodies faithful resistance to the secular order. His struggle is primarily internal, maintaining faith in a world that has rejected God. Yet his conviction never wavers, despite periods of spiritual desolation. The Church's response to persecution comes through the creation of a new religious order, the Order of Christ Crucified. Its members take traditional vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, but also embrace the likelihood of martyrdom. They wear no special habits or insignia, living among the secular population as witnesses to transcendent truth. When persecution intensifies, many face death rather than deny their faith. Benson portrays this resistance with psychological depth. The faithful don't seek martyrdom, but they accept it when faith demands it. Their courage comes not from political ideology, but from supernatural conviction. In one powerful scene, Percy experiences a mystical vision of the body mystical of Christ stretched in agony over the world, bleeding while mockers gather below. This image encapsulates the novel's view of the Church, suffering yet spiritually alive in a world that has rejected it. What makes this portrayal compelling is its realism about the challenges of faith. Percy experiences periods of doubt when darkness became intolerable, and his dignity seemed a fool's insignia. Yet even in these moments, like Christ on the cross, he cries, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." The novel suggests that authentic faith includes moments of darkness and questioning, yet perseveres through them. One of the novel's most disturbing elements is its portrayal of how secularism evolves into a formal religion. Felsenburgh's government establishes divine worship with four annual feasts honoring aspects of human life: paternity, maternity, life, and sustenance. Westminster Abbey becomes the temple for this new cult, with ceremonies designed by former Catholic priests who now serve the state. The rituals deliberately mimic Catholic worship while replacing God with humanity. Processions enter the abbey, aspirations are sung by choirs, and images are sensed. For the Feast of Maternity, Markenheim creates a nude woman, majestic and lovely, crowned with 12 stars, a perversion of Catholic Marian imagery. When Percy sees this image, he tears it to shreds and falls before his prideew in reparation to the true Queen of Heaven. What makes this new religion so seductive is its incorporation of genuine human needs for ritual, community, and transcendence while removing moral demands. As Mr. Francis explains, it offers Catholicism without Christianity, humanity worship without inadequacy, recognizing sacrifice without demanding holiness. Mabel Brand initially finds it beautiful and real, appreciating that concrete images provide channels for human aspiration. The climax of this religious perversion comes when Felsenburgh appears at the abbey for the Feast of Maternity. Standing before the mother image, he cries, "Oh, mother of us all, and mother of me!" He appropriates traditional Marian titles, Wisdom of the Most High, Gate of Heaven, House of Ivory, for this human idol. The crowd responds with religious ecstasy, and Felsenburgh appears transfigured in blazing light as 10,000 voices thundered their worship, hailing him Lord and God. Benson's insight here is profound. Humans are inherently religious beings who will create objects of worship even in supposedly secular societies. The novel suggests that secular humanism doesn't eliminate religion, but transforms it into something potentially more dangerous because it lacks transcendent moral constraints. As Felsenburgh consolidates power, his government moves from promoting secular humanism to actively persecuting religious believers. The progression is logical and terrifying. First, marginalizing faith as irrelevant, then declaring it dangerous to social unity, and finally outlawing it entirely. The final policy declares that anyone claiming to believe in God is committing high treason against humanity and will face merciful euthanasia. This policy creates moral crises for several characters. Oliver Brand, initially a principled humanitarian, signs the decree ordering believers' execution. His wife Mabel, though devoted to the new order, cannot reconcile herself to this deliberate persecution. She laments that war and passion and murder had returned despite the coming of their savior Julian. Her disillusionment eventually leads her to seek euthanasia herself. The final policy explores how voluntary euthanasia becomes a tool of both personal despair and state control. Mabel enters a home of rest in Manchester, seeking death as escape from a world she can no longer bear. The procedure is portrayed as clinical and efficient, a mouthpiece emitting a sweet, languid smell of death. Yet in her final moments, Mabel experiences a profound revelation that suggests transcendent reality beyond material existence. More sinister is how euthanasia becomes the state's method of eliminating dissidents. When Catholics are discovered plotting against the government, mobs take vengeance, hanging priests and burning churches. The government sends volars to destroy Rome itself, killing approximately 30,000 people, including church leadership. The newspapers call this a cheap price for extermination of the Catholic pest. Benson's portrayal of persecution is chilling because it comes not from obvious villains, but from well-meaning people convinced they're creating a better world. The novel suggests that when humanity becomes its own god, it loses moral constraints against violence toward those who challenge its self-worship. Beyond its apocalyptic themes, Lord of the World is deeply concerned with how faith affects personal relationships. This dimension appears most poignantly in the Brand family. Oliver Brand, the communist politician who champions secular humanism, is married to Mabel, a devoted humanist who shares his progressive worldview. His mother, however, secretly returns to Catholicism before her death, a decision that catalyzes the novel's exploration of how religious beliefs can fracture even the closest family bonds. The tension reaches its climax when Percy Franklin, a Catholic priest, visits the dying Mrs. Brand to reconcile her with the church. Oliver and Mabel's unexpected discovery of him in their home becomes a pivotal moment that crystallizes the personal cost of ideological divisions. Oliver's fury at finding a priest with his mother reveals not just anger, but a deep sense of betrayal, that his own mother would reject the secular worldview he has dedicated his life to advancing. Meanwhile, Mabel's curious politeness toward Percy suggests an internal struggle between her humanist convictions and an innate respect for others' spiritual needs. The scene of Mrs. Brand's death is particularly revealing. The old woman dies clutching her rosary beads, a powerful symbol of her return to faith. Oliver's surprising response, "Leave her in peace. I would not move it for the world. It was her toy," reveals complex layers of emotion, respect for his mother's choices, even while dismissing her faith as mere comfort, and perhaps a glimpse of his own suppressed spiritual yearnings. The deterioration of Oliver and Mabel's marriage serves as a microcosm of the broader societal conflict. Their relationship, initially celebrated as a double affection of mind as well as body, begins to unravel when Oliver signs the decree ordering Catholics' execution. His justification relies on cold utilitarian logic. Individualism is dead, he argues, and humanity functions as a single entity that must protect itself from division. But Mabel, though sharing his humanist beliefs, discovers her own moral limits when confronted with systematic cruelty. Through these intimate portraits, the novel suggests that faith is not merely a private matter, but fundamentally shapes our deepest relationships and moral choices. When societies reject transcendent moral foundations, even the most loving relationships become vulnerable to ideological demands. The personal becomes political in the most painful way, as characters must choose between loyalty to their beliefs and loyalty to their loved ones. This tension creates rifts that no amount of rational argument or shared history can bridge, suggesting that the cost of enforced secular uniformity might be the destruction of our most fundamental human bonds. As persecution intensifies, the novel builds toward an apocalyptic conclusion that masterfully weaves together intimate human drama with cosmic spiritual warfare. The Pope and remaining church leadership retreat to Nazareth, a location chosen with deep symbolic significance as the place where Christianity began with the Annunciation to Mary. There, in a whitewashed room of stark simplicity that stands in deliberate contrast to the technological marvels of Felsenburgh's world, Pope Sylvester, formerly Percy Franklin, continues his ministry while awaiting the end. The final confrontation occurs on Pentecost, a feast commemorating the Holy Spirit's descent upon the early church. The Pope celebrates Mass with the remaining faithful in a scene that deliberately mirrors the early Christians worshiping in the catacombs. The liturgy unfolds with ancient prayers in Latin, creating a temporal bridge between the first Christians and these last ones. As they worship, messengers bring increasingly urgent reports of Felsenburgh's forces methodically eliminating the last pockets of Christian resistance worldwide. Benson's description of this final moment operates on multiple levels, physical, psychological, and mystical. The transformation of the sky becomes a metaphor for spiritual reality breaking through material existence, from darkness charged with light to light overlaid with darkness, from glimmering night to wrathful day, and that light was red. The faithful continue singing the Eucharistic hymn, Tantum Ergo, their voices steady despite the approaching doom. Meanwhile, Felsenburgh approaches in his swift chariot, blind to all save what had fixed his eyes, unaware that his world corrupted around him, a powerful image of technological hubris meeting divine judgment. The novel's conclusion demonstrates masterful ambiguity. Then, this world passed, and the glory of it. This single line carries multiple interpretations. It could mean the literal end of the physical world, the passing of Felsenburgh's materialistic kingdom, or the transcendence of spiritual reality over material existence. The uncertainty serves Benson's purpose by forcing readers to wrestle with deeper questions about ultimate meaning and truth. This apocalyptic ending, while potentially melodramatic to modern sensibilities, serves several crucial functions in Benson's theological vision. It affirms that history has meaning and direction rather than being merely cyclical or random. It suggests that apparent defeats mask deeper victories. The martyr's blood becomes the seed of future faith. The conclusion also challenges the modern assumption that material progress equals moral advancement, showing how technological sophistication can mask spiritual poverty. Through this ending, Benson argues that faithful witness matters even when it seems futile by worldly standards. The small band of believers singing ancient hymns in the face of overwhelming force becomes an image of the church's perpetual situation in a hostile world. Their apparent defeat paradoxically reveals their triumph, choosing truth over survival, faith over compromise. Written over a century ago, Lord of the World contains remarkable predictions about technology, politics, and culture that feel eerily prescient today. Benson foresaw flying machines that mirror our modern aircraft, mass communication systems resembling our internet and social media, euthanasia as accepted social policy, and the rise of a unified Europe that parallels the European Union. His vision extended beyond mere technological forecasting to anticipate the deeper spiritual crisis of modernity, the increasingly desperate attempt to build meaning and purpose without transcendent foundations in an age of scientific materialism. The novel presents several profound warnings about dangerous tendencies in modern society. First, it cautions against placing absolute faith in political solutions to fundamentally spiritual problems. Through the character of Julian Felsenburgh, Benson illustrates how charismatic political leaders promising universal peace and human brotherhood often deliver tyranny instead, precisely because they demand the kind of total devotion properly given only to God. The novel shows how political movements can transform into pseudo-religions, complete with their own rituals, saints, and demands for absolute loyalty. Second, it warns against reducing religion to mere social ethics while abandoning transcendent truth claims. The new state religion in the novel preserves the outward forms of ritual and community, but lacks any moral authority beyond human consensus. This mirrors contemporary attempts to preserve religious traditions as cultural heritage while emptying them of supernatural content, what sociologists call moralistic therapeutic deism. Most profoundly, the novel challenges the modern assumption that humanity can create sufficient meaning for itself through reason and science alone. When Oliver tells his wife Mabel that death simply means returning to the reservoir of universal energy, she initially accepts this materialist philosophy. Yet when actually facing death, she discovers its profound inadequacy. Human-created meaning systems collapse when confronting ultimate questions about existence, purpose, and mortality. The novel suggests that without reference to transcendent reality, attempts to construct meaning remain fundamentally unstable. The book's relevance has only grown as contemporary societies struggle with questions of meaning, community, and transcendence in an increasingly technological and secular age. Pope Francis specifically highlighted its prophetic nature, noting how it reveals how ideologies that want to impose themselves on reality always end in dictatorships. The novel's depiction of a world where comfort and efficiency mask spiritual emptiness resonates with modern concerns about digital technology, surveillance, and the commodification of human life. In an era where artificial intelligence and biotechnology raise fundamental questions about human nature and purpose, Benson's warning about the spiritual consequences of rejecting transcendence remains remarkably powerful and timely. Despite its apocalyptic tone, Lord of the World ultimately offers a profound message of hope. This hope doesn't emerge through political victory or cultural dominance, but through faithful witness even in apparent defeat. The novel suggests that authentic faith persists not because it promises worldly success, but because it corresponds to a deeper reality beyond material existence, a reality that transcends temporal circumstances and societal upheavals. The faithful in Benson's novel don't actively seek martyrdom, but they accept it as a potential consequence rather than deny truth. Their resistance isn't primarily political, but spiritual, maintaining steadfast faith in a world that has systematically rejected God. Percy Franklin, the central character, experiences intense periods of desolation and doubt when faith seems not merely difficult, but impossible. Yet he perseveres through these dark nights of the soul, his spiritual journey moving beyond emotional consolations to what Benson describes as a purely spiritual realm where God is grasped but not experienced, a state of pure faith stripped of all comfort. This vision of faithful witness speaks powerfully to believers in every age who find themselves increasingly at odds with prevailing culture. The novel presents numerous examples of individuals maintaining their faith despite social ostracism, professional consequences, and personal loss. It suggests that the church's strength lies not in political power or cultural influence, but in spiritual authenticity, in being what Benson calls the bones of the universe when everything else proves ephemeral and transient. The characters demonstrate this faithfulness in various ways, some through quiet persistence in daily religious practice, others through bold public witness, and still others through simple acts of mercy and charity that contrast sharply with the utilitarian values of their society. Their struggles mirror contemporary challenges faced by religious believers in increasingly secular societies, from workplace discrimination to social marginalization. The novel's climactic final scene, where the Eucharist is celebrated while the world literally ends around the faithful, powerfully symbolizes this priority of spiritual over material reality. Even as apocalyptic destruction unfolds outside, the faithful continue their worship with profound peace and dignity, affirming that communion with God transcends worldly catastrophe. This scene serves as both a literal and metaphorical representation of the novel's central theme, that faithful witness maintains its value even in the face of apparent futility. In our own age of anxiety, uncertainty, and rapid social change, Benson's vision reminds us that faithful witness matters even when it appears ineffective or counterproductive. The novel's enduring power lies in this affirmation that truth persists beyond the rise and fall of civilizations, and that genuine faith offers hope even in humanity's darkest hour. Through its character struggles and ultimate perseverance, the novel demonstrates how authentic faith can provide not just personal comfort, but a genuine alternative to the various forms of materialism and despair that characterize modern life.